This is Focus 580. It's our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening this morning. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Bob Harvey. He's an author and cartoon historian. He's been with us before on the program to talk a little bit about the development and the history of this art form. He has authored several books. I want to mention a couple of titles. Two of them similar, The Art of the Comic Book and Aesthetic History, and The Art of the Funnies and Aesthetic History. Both of these are published by University Press of Mississippi. He is also the co-author of a book titled Children of the Yellow Kid, The Evolution of the American Comic Strip. And this is a book published by University of Washington Press that was the catalog for an exhibition at Seattle's Frye Art Museum that looked at the 100-year evolution of American newspaper comics. So if you're interested in the history of this medium, Bob's books are out there and they're available. And as we talk, there are a couple things we thought we might talk about this morning, among them editorial cartooning. But if you have other sorts of questions that have to do with cartooning, with the newspaper strip, with the comic art, all of those things we've talked about before, and he knows a lot about those things. So I don't want to exclude anybody if your question happened to be on something other than editorial cartooning that we thought, we'll at least start out talking about that this morning. Questions are certainly welcome. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That means if it would be long distance, you can use that number. That's 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Well, thank you very much once again for being with us.
Well, I enjoy being here. Thank you for having me again.
We just discovered this morning that it's been appropriately enough, we are now in Cartoon Appreciation Week, so declared by the National Cartoonists Society.
Yes.
Tomorrow, in fact, is Cartoonist Day.
I don't know if there'll be any parades or not.
Probably not, but I guess part of the idea is that maybe cartoonists were people who have strips and newspapers may make some acknowledgement of this fact in their artwork. Do you know something about the history of this, how it is Cartoonist Day came?
Oh, yes. Well, it's the 5th of May, and there is a it is a tradition or a legend or a myth that the first American comic strip was called The Yellow Kid. And the first Yellow Kid appeared on the 5th of May, 1895, in the New York World. It wasn't called The Yellow Kid. It was called Hogan's Alley or some variation of that title. And it didn't get called The Yellow Kid until almost a year later. The kid in question was a dweller of the New York slums, as all the kids were in this feature. It wasn't a strip. It was a large drawing with all these kids doing various things in the back lots of the slums on the Lower East Side in New York. And one of the kids was an Irish kid named Mickey Dugan, who didn't have any hair. He was completely bald, and he wore a nightshirt. He probably didn't have any hair because his head had been shaved because he had lice or something like that. That's the probable thing. But anyway, he kept showing up in this Hogan's Alley strip. And then in January of 1896, somebody in the press room colored his shirt yellow, and he became known as the Yellow Kid and made a lot of money for the newspaper. And Richard Alcott, who was the cartoonist, he first appeared in the New York World in the fall of 1896. William Randolph Hearst bought a New York paper and immediately hired Alcott away to draw the Yellow Kid for him, which is an indication of how popular the feature was. Mm-hmm. Pulitzer hired Alcott back for about 3 days, and then Hearst outbid him, and he got a hold of the Yellow Kid forever after. It only ran for a couple more years after that, but it demonstrated the circulation-building power of a cartoon feature. Delivery trucks would have big posters on the side with pictures of the Yellow Kid on it, and people were all talking about the Yellow Kid. So that's why it's the 5th of May. Mm.
And am I right in thinking that that's where the phrase yellow journalism
yes.
comes from?
Yeah, there are people who will debate that too, but my understanding is that the Hearst paper, the New York Journal, and Pulitzer's paper, The World, had this enormous circulation battle going, and they engaged in some very sensational tactics to attract readers. Most newspapers were bought off the street in those days, so it was the headline on the front page that attracted the attention. And for a while, neither one of them paid very much attention to whether the headlines were truthful or not. They became very sensational. And since the Yellow Kid was an occupant of both of these papers and their delivery wagons featured him on the side, why, the bystanders to this battle for readers referred to the Yellow Journals, and their tactics became known as yellow journalism.
All right, very good. Well, our guest this morning in this part of Focus 580 is Bob Harvey. He's a cartoon historian, and any questions you might have about the comic art, the cartoon art, you can certainly call 333-WILL and toll free 800-222-WILL. Well, we did say that we might talk a little bit about editorial cartooning, and one thing we could do, I guess, to start out here is acknowledge the winner of the Pulitzer Prize for this year, for 2001, for editorial cartooning, is a woman. And this is notable because I think that you said that only one other woman had won the Pulitzer for editorial cartoons.
That's partly reflecting the fact that there have been very few women editorial cartoonists, just as there have been very few women in most phases of American life, which is a social problem rather than a cartooning problem. But the two winners, the other one is Signe Wilkinson of the Philadelphia Daily News, I think, and she won it in 1992. So there have been two women winners in the Pulitzer editorial cartoon category in the last 10 years, which is pretty darn good, really, particularly when you consider there are probably only five or six more women cartoonists practicing in the field. There are about 150 or 200 editorial cartoonists. Probably only 150 of them work full-time at it. And of that full-time number, there are probably only four or five who are women. So their winning percentage is pretty high. Ann Telness came into cartooning by way of animation, and her drawing style will remind people of Warner Brothers cartoon characters and that kind of drawing. But she's very, very good. In my view, a really good editorial cartoonist is one who makes use of the visual nature of the medium to create a metaphor that carries the message. And it's the metaphor that gets buried in the back of your head and influences your thinking. If it's going to influence you at all. And she's awfully good at this, drawing pictures that in the picture itself there's a suggestion of what her message is going to be. Too many editorial cartoonists these days, it seems to me, rely on the verbal content of their cartoon to make their point. For example, I've seen probably hundreds of editorial cartoons of a husband and wife sitting on the couch watching TV and making some comment about what's going on TV, mm-hmm. which can be political news or sporting news or anything else. And that's verbal ingenuity, but it doesn't make use of a metaphor. The only metaphor present there is two people watching TV, and that doesn't make the case, it seems to me, as well as the visual metaphor that's skillfully employed. Mm. One of the most stunning examples of a visual metaphor was a cartoon done during the 1950s by Herbert Block, who signs his cartoons Herblock. And this was during the McCarthy period. And it was a picture of the arm of the Statue of Liberty with the torch alight at the top of it. And someone is running up, a small man is running up the side of a ladder carrying a bucket of water, which is labeled McCarthyism, and he's yelling, "Fire!" He's going to put out the torch, which, of course, is the torch of representing the torch of freedom and liberty and all the rest of it. So it was a stunning visual image. Another one of the great visual images, it's sometimes even called the perfect editorial cartoon, was drawn before World War I by a cartoonist named Robert Minor, and it is ostensibly the medical examination of a recruit who is entering the army, and the doctor is rubbing his hands, and the recruit is standing there. There's a huge torso and arms, but no head at all, and the doctor is saying, "Ah, the perfect soldier." So that's another image that that works. Ann Telness is awfully hard-hitting. She doesn't pull her punches at all, and she doesn't do cartoons just to be funny, which is what a lot of cartoonists nowadays do. In fact, the editorial cartooning fraternity is concerned these days that it is becoming extinct, largely because, let's see how to explain this. Most editorial cartoonists have a home-based newspaper. They work on a newspaper. Ann Telness, as it happens, does not. She's one of very few that this is true of. In addition to doing cartoons for their home newspaper, many of them, in fact most of them, are also syndicated by one of the national feature syndicates who send their cartoons all around the country, and they're purchased by newspapers. The News Gazette uses a syndicate service for all of its editorial cartoons. So they get some additional income through the syndication process. In order to be syndicated, however, you must produce a certain number of national topic, national issue cartoons every week. And the contract usually calls for something like four. So if you draw six cartoons a week, only two of them are going to be on local issues. Every cartoonist knows that he gets more bang for the buck out of a cartoon on local issues than he does out of one on national issues. But their syndicate arrangement causes them to draw more on national issues. Their editors also seem to prefer national issues because they don't get as many irate phone calls from readers as they do when the cartoonist pokes fun at some local issue. So there's a kind of implicit conspiracy here, nudging editorial cartoonists out of the offices of newspapers, because if the editors don't want anybody on local issues because they cause trouble, they can get national issue cartoons through syndication. Why hire a local editorial cartoonist? Why have an editorial cartoonist on your staff at all? And this is another reason that Ann Telness's win this year is interesting. It's only happened once or twice before that an editorial cartoonist without a home paper has won the Pulitzer. And the only other time, strictly speaking, was when Herblock won it in 1942, and he was working for NEA, a syndicate, rather than the Washington Post. And then there were two comic strip artists who won it. They were also syndicated. That's Gary Trudeau and Burke Breathed for Doonesbury and Bloom County. That was kind of controversial. But since they made comment on political and social issues, they were regarded as editorial cartoonists, I guess. Anyway, Ann Telness is only the second one, let's say, who's been distributed solely by syndication and has no home paper, which means she doesn't draw on any local issues. Now, as it happens, Ann lives in Washington, D.C., so all national issue cartoons are local issue cartoons, right, as far as she's concerned.
We're talking this morning with cartoon historian Bob Harvey. He's authored several books, so if you're interested in the history of things like cartoon strips that appear in newspapers or comic books, you can look for those books. He also, by the way, has a website, and there are a number of essays and articles and things on there if you want to also take a look at that. It's www.rcharvey.com, so you can check that out. And your questions are welcome. And we had somebody, my apologies, maybe we made him wait too long. You want to call back, or if anybody else who has questions, comments, observations about cartoons, cartooning, you can call us 333-9455. And that's for here for Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free, 800-222-9455.
I might point out that for reasons that are probably obvious, editorial cartoonists are always considered the, bellwethers for the profession or something like that. Editorial cartooning is, as viewed by the general public, I think, is regarded as a serious social enterprise, as opposed to comic strip cartooning or gag cartooning, which is regarded as a frivolous entertainment. So editorial cartoonists have greater social status, particularly in history books, than strip cartoonists do. There were a few cases of, you know, really spectacular impact that an editorial cartoonist has. The most famous one in this country is Thomas Nast, who attacked the boss of the political ring in New York, whose name was William Tweed. Attacked him and the Tweed Ring. In fact, there's a good chance that Nast actually invented the expression the Tweed Ring to describe the Tammany Hall politicians that controlled New York at the time. And his most famous cartoon of Tweed shows Tweed and a number of his ring perched on the edge of a cliff wearing feathers like birds, and the caption of the cartoon is, "Let us pray." Pray is spelled P-R-E-Y. And His caricatured Tweed, of course, and made the whole issue very visible. And eventually, Tweed was driven out of office, and because he had made millions of dollars through corrupt influence in New York politics, he had to leave the country. He was arrested in Spain by immigration officers who recognized him from Nast's drawings. So that's a kind of a famous instance of the effect of editorial cartooning. One of the early editorial cartoonists was a man named Charles Philippon, who drew, who founded a couple of papers in Paris, in France, one of which was called Les Charivaris, and in it he drew a caricature of King Louis-Philippe, which made him look like a pear. It was a progression of images. The first was a picture of Louis-Philippe, and then the next image, because he was kind of jowly, it began to look a little bit more like a pear, and by the time the fourth image was up, there was a picture of a pear. And Philippon was put on trial for this because the word pear in French is slang for fathead. So he was, in effect, showing the king of France he was a fathead. So that's another instance of something powerful happening. As a general rule, editorial cartoonists don't expect to have like a one-to-one relationship on events. Doug Marlette, is an editorial cartoonist who draws a cartoon called Kudzu, he was asked one time if he had any real effect on events, and he said, "Well, I ended the Vietnam War," but of course he didn't. He didn't really mean that.
Well, it does seem certainly to be the case, because they do engage in caricature, that they have a lot to do with shaping the way that we see politicians. Mm. Particularly, it makes me think of, going back to Herblock, the cartoons that he drew of Richard Nixon.
Yes, always with a 5 o'clock shadow.
Yes, right. Indeed. That really, and always with a rather sort of furtive,
yes.
sort of guilty expression, as if he's afraid that he's going to be yes. he's done something that's going to be found out. And I'm sure that with other politicians, particularly presidents, that yeah. these cartoonists, the ones who are nationally syndicated, do shape our images. What comes to mind when we think of that
person?
Oh,
yeah. Bush, for example, is being caricatured as a very small guy with big ears. And initially, he was drawn with Dick Cheney, and Dick Cheney was always portrayed as a very dignified, knowledgeable individual, and Bush as a kind of child let loose from the nursery to play in the Oval Office for a while. And those images are having some kind of an effect, I would assume. I mean, probably don't make Bush feel good. What's his name? Gingrich got caricatured by Mike Lukovich at the Atlanta Constitution when it was revealed that he had asked his wife for a divorce when his wife was in the hospital being treated for cancer. And Lukovich drew a picture of Gingrich asking his wife for a divorce, and he was standing next to her bedside, and on each arm were bimbos labeled U.S. Congress or something like that. And Gingrich was so irate that he refused to let reporters from the Atlanta Constitution, Lukovich's paper, come into any of his news conferences. I don't know how long that lasted, but it lasted for a while.
You talked about how sometimes the deciding what is an editorial cartoon may be a little bit difficult, and you made reference to Doonesbury and to Bloom County. And mm-hmm. Certainly there have been times when at various papers they thought the content of the Doonesbury was controversial enough so that they actually took it off of the comics page and they put it on the editorial
right,
page.
Right.
How do you decide what is or is not an editorial cartoon?
Well, the editorial cartoons are the big square ones.
That's the shape. If they're long and rectangular, it's
then
a comic,
they're not.
Then they're not.
Cartoon.
But if they're square, okay.
Yes, right. In fact, it's kind of odd given the tenuous grip on staff positions that editorial cartoonists have. There are only a couple newspapers in the country that don't use editorial cartoonists, that don't use editorial cartoons on their editorial page. In fact, the average reader knows he's hit the editorial page when he sees a big cartoon in the corner. That's how you know. So the place of the editorial cartoon in the newspaper is probably pretty secure. The question of whether there are going to be any staff cartoonists in 15 or 20 years is another question. Maybe there will be some kind of a comeback. I don't know.
Hmm. We're getting pretty close to the midpoint here. Again, our guest is Bob Harvey. He is an author and cartoon historian. He's authored several books about the aesthetic of the funnies and of the comic book. Those two books are published by the University Press of Mississippi. Another I mentioned at the beginning of the show was this book that he co-authored, which is titled Children of the Yellow Kid, The Evolution of the American Comic Strip. And this is one that was a catalog for an exhibition that took place in 1998 at Seattle's Fry Art Museum, which looked at the evolution of the American newspaper comic. And your questions are welcome. We got somebody here ready to go, and others are welcome to call. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Why don't we talk with here, this listener, and we have somebody in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yeah. I just wanted to mention an editorial cartoon that really struck my fancy back in about the middle of January. It came out of the Cincinnati Enquirer. I wonder if the guest has any idea which one I'm talking about.
Probably not, but the Cincinnati Enquirer's cartoonist is Jim Borgman.
Yeah, I think that was it. Yeah, well, this was a picture of a fairly wrinkled old man in a black robe standing over a grate on the sidewalk, kind of Marilyn Monroe style, and the wind was blowing up from the grate and raising his robes, and underneath the robes, you saw these big, wrinkled, fat elephant's feet, and on the black robe was entitled Supreme Court.
Yes, right.
Yeah.
That was undoubtedly a comment on the election in December.
Yeah, right.
I don't remember seeing that one. It is a good one, though.
Yeah. On another subject, while I've got it, I just wondered, you know, there's some old comic strips I remember from when I was younger that seem to have disappeared, and I wonder if you can mention anything about them, if you know about them, and how long they may have gone when they quit.
Okay.
The one in particular, well, there are two. Maybe they were the same one. I don't know. I can't remember. One was Tim Tyler's Luck, and the other one, I can't remember exactly the name. It might have been the same one. It had characters Bathless Groggins.
Oh, yes.
And his daughter, Becky.
That was called Abby and Slats.
Oh, Abby and Slats.
Yeah, Bathless Goggins was the character that was featured in the Sunday strip. Very often, cartoonists produced a different storyline for Sundays than appeared in the dailies, and Abby and Slats was a storytelling strip, so there was a continuity that appeared in the daily strips and then a different one in the Sunday.
Right.
And the Sunday concentrated, after a few years, pretty much on the rather humorous adventures of this Bathless Groggins character. I can't remember, it was his daughter named Betty, or was she?
Becky Groggins.
Becky, that was it. And she was the girlfriend of one of the title characters, Slats. Abby was a spinster aunt, and Slats was her nephew.
Yeah.
And Bathless Groggins was this comic character that appeared on Sundays. The reason they ran two continuities is that the Sunday strip had to be prepared 10 weeks in advance of publication, and the dailies could be prepared as little as 4 weeks. So in order to have an integrated storyline for all 7 days, you had to write the whole story out considerably in advance so you would know how the pieces would come together. The other strip you mentioned, Tim Tyler's Luck, started shortly after Charles Lindbergh's transatlantic flight in, when that was, May 1927, something like that. And within a year or two, there were a couple of comic strips that began that were about youthful airplane pilots, and Tim Tyler's Luck was one of them. He eventually got out of the airplane business, and it became just a boys' adventure strip. Tim was a young fellow. He's probably, I don't know, 17 or 18. There are some interesting things about Tim Tyler's Luck. It was attributed to, the byline was always Lyman Young, who was the brother of Chick Young, who Blondie, the comic strip Blondie. But Lyman Young could not draw very realistically, so very, very soon he handed the drawing chores off to an assistant who could draw realistically enough to make the stories in Tim Tyler's Luck seem persuasive. One of his assistants at one time was Alex Raymond, who went on to draw and invent Flash Gordon and Jungle Jim and Rip Kirby and Secret Agent X9, to name the four strips he became known for. Raymond, as chance would have it, He also at one time worked for Chick Young, drawing Blondie. In fact, the famous wedding scene when Blondie and Dag would get married is supposedly drawn by Chick Young, or by Alex Raymond.
Hmm. Yeah. Do you happen to know when they ended?
Abby and Slats probably ended in the 60s or 70s, and that's about when Tim Tyler's Luck ended, too. Tim Tyler's Luck actually went on a whole lot longer than I thought it did. I thought it ended by World War II, but it actually continued into the 50s and maybe as far as the 60s, but I don't know exactly.
Yeah, I think both these characters, Slats and Tim Tyler, I think was in the Navy during the war, and forget about Slats.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, well, thanks very much.
You're
okay,
welcome.
Thank you. Let's go to someone else here in Champaign. It's line two. Hello.
Oh, hello. What would you say was the proportion of political cartoonists that were that are conservative and liberal?
I don't know. I think probably there are more liberal editorial cartoonists in the history of editorial cartooning than there are conservative ones, at least among those who are nationally known. Probably the first so-called conservative editorial cartoonist in recent times who by winning a Pulitzer Prize, sort of established a beachhead for conservative editorial cartoonists. That was Jeff McNally, who died last year. And he was an excellent editorial cartoonist, a very good, and particularly the last 5 or 10 years of his life, his work was very hard-hitting and very he used this visual metaphor business, I think, as well as anybody ever did. He's probably he and Pat Oliphant are probably the towering figures in the last quarter century in the history of editorial cartooning. There are today a number of conservative editorial cartoonists, just as, of course, there are liberal ones. There's an association called the American Association, or the Association of American Editorial Cartoonists, has an annual convention. And last year, just to indicate how these things go, the guest speaker was Charlton Heston. And you probably wouldn't find him speaking to that group 20 years ago. But now there are enough so-called conservative editorial cartoonists that that their interests at this annual convention must be attended to.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you.
All right. Thank you. I'm really surprised, I guess, to hear you say that McNally was conservative. I guess, having looked at his cartoons, I wouldn't have thought that.
No, I wouldn't have thought it either, looking at his cartoons. But because he delighted, he probably, he was more interested in the comedy of malfeasance, I suppose, than anything else. And his cartoons were, like Pat Oliphant's frequently are funny. They're humorous cartoons, and very often. And he was interested in all kinds of foolishness, or things that he thought were foolish, things done by national political figures. And he wasn't he would poke fun at them whether they were conservative or liberal. It didn't matter. If they did something that he thought was foolish, why, they were his legitimate target. But he was, by inclination, conservative. A lot of editorial cartoonists today, when George Bush was elected, they were really caught on the horns of a dilemma. As cartoonists, they all wanted Bush to be elected because he would be much better to make fun of. There's much more about George Bush to make fun of. The fact that he can't quite get a paragraph out by himself without mangling it is subject for cartooning, and his appearance, he has a vaguely simian appearance, so he can be drawn as a chimpanzee if they want to. His relationship to the power figures that he's got around him makes him seem to be a trivial character. Anyway, but many of them would have preferred Gore as a voter, as a so-called concerned citizen, but they prefer Bush as a cartoonist target.
Let's go to Danville. Here, line number four. Hello.
Yes, plenty of political cartoon drawings. Over time, like if you look at an older one, say, of Cannon or of Lincoln or some other ones like that, you know, the person today looks at it and doesn't quite get the point they're getting at because they were not around at the time or have a vast enough knowledge as a contemporary one would be. Do you find that more hard than it would be today?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
Okay, that, well, maybe drawing, you don't know what they're saying.
The point of is that I think in when you look at editorial cartoons of the past, that it's really unless you really knew what was going on at the time, you look at the cartoon and it really wouldn't mean much to you.
Well, I think that's true in the past. I think it's true today too. They're extremely topical, and if you're not into the history of the period. It doesn't do much good to read editorial cartoons drawn in the 1880s, for example, because they don't make much sense.
Well, by the same token, on strips, you know, over time, some of them have been written for several years.
Yeah.
You know, the characters, of course, some of that's more fictional than actual, that it's changed over the years, you know, because the characters might have to evolve to the times. If you look at an older one and you look at a new one written by the same character, you know, may not be the same artist or whatever, but the same characters, you must say, is this the same person?
Sometimes they're drawn by the same person. A person's drawing style evolves slowly. Very often they're drawn by a completely different individual. Some of the older strips, for example, well, Gasoline Alley is a good example. It's now in its in the hands of its third caretaker, third cartoonist to inherit the strip and produce it on a daily basis. And they draw a little bit differently than their predecessors do. Dick Tracy is another example. He's now... Dick Locher, who draws it now, he's also an editorial cartoonist, and I think he's the third person to draw it after Chet Gould, who was the creator of the strip.
But isn't the plots even different, too?
Oh, yeah, I suppose so. Particularly with storytelling strips, there aren't very many of them left. Storytelling strips have almost completely disappeared. Dick Tracy is one of the few left, and it's even being written by somebody else. The cartoonist, the man who draws it, doesn't write it. It's written by someone else.
Isn't also some of the comic book characters even changed? Some of them are bad guys, now good guys even?
Yeah, and I guess that's true. There have been comic book characters who started out as bad guys and became good guys. I think, well, one of the arch foes of Batman, for example, was the Catwoman, and I think by now she's in a comic book of her own with her own title, and she's now some kind of a good guy. I don't know how they pull this off, but they do it.
Thank you.
Okay. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We were talking a little bit ago about Jeff McNally, who passed away not very long ago.
About a year ago, actually. Yeah.
And I guess I was sort of – he also drew the comic strip Shoe.
Yes.
And I was surprised when the strip continued after his death, and I guess finally I caught on to the fact, well, somebody else is drawing it.
Yes, right.
How did that happen, that somebody else came along and took it over?
Well, Jeff McNally had been using a drawing assistant for maybe 10 years, and the strip itself is circulated to about 1,000 newspapers or so, which represents a considerable income to the syndicate that distributes the strip. And no syndicate wants to give up a moneymaker like that if they can avoid it. And considering that McNally had an assistant who had been working with him, they were able to work out perhaps one of the most unusual continuation arrangements in the history of the medium, because it involves a computer. The Daily and Sunday Shoe comic strip begins in Aspen, Colorado, where there is this McNally's computer assistant, so to speak, lives, and he roughs out. He works with gag writers and other people who send him ideas for the strip. And after he picks the gags that he wants to use, which he does in conjunction with Jeff McNally's widow, then he uses his computer to conjure up the images for the strip, and transmits this to a man in. Where is it? Raleigh. Richmond. I think it's Richmond. And his name is Gary Brookins. And Gary Brookins actually draws the strip using the computer images that the other fellow, Craig Cassette, has transmitted to him. But each picture is freshly drawn, so it's not, you know, completely generated by computer, particularly on Sundays when their images are quite elaborate sometimes. Mm. Trying to think. Now, Cassette, the guy, this computer guy in Aspen, he got involved with McNally when McNally one time was visiting there. McNally's son lived and worked in Aspen, That's where he died in a mountain accident, mountain climbing accident. And he met this guy Cassette, and they weren't talking. And McNally sort of complained about how boring it was to draw the same picture over and over and over again. And so, and it wasn't so much drawing the same picture over and over again. It was making the picture fit into those little squares of a comic strip. So Cassette said, well, I can help you with that. Just you draw a picture, whatever you want, any size, send it to me on the internet, and then I'll manipulate the image. I'll turn it around or crop the edges and make it fit in the squares and put the lettering in, and you won't have to worry about all that mechanical stuff. So that's how that got started and worked pretty well. It's kind of funny to me that Hsu runs on the editorial page of the News Gazette, and I think that's because they think McNally is a conservative. I mean, they threw, what was the name of that duck strip?
Mallard Fillmore.
They threw it off. Now, Mallard Fillmore is an unabashed, no-holds-barred conservative attack on everything that any liberal ever wanted to believe in. Mm-hmm. And they got rid of that, but then they imported Hsu there. And, of course, Hsu, even when McNally was doing it, didn't have a particular point of view, editorially speaking.
It was more of your joke day strips,
yeah,
like
oh, yeah.
So many.
Yeah, right.
We have another caller here. This is Kansas, Illinois. Let's go there. Line number four. Hello.
Yes. I had a question. Back in the 60s, there was a cartoon in the Chicago Trib that I read growing up. The name of it was called Rick O'Shea.
It was
a Western-type comic, and I think it had a gunfighter by the name of Hipshot Percussion in it.
Right.
And I was wondering if you knew who drew that and what happened to that strip.
Well, the person who drew it, his name is Stan Lynde, L-Y-N-D-E, and he grew up in Montana, and so his understanding of Western themes was part of his personal heritage. He stopped doing the strip, I believe, in a dispute with the syndicate over either salary or rights to the strip or something. Most comic strips back in that time were owned by the syndicate, not by the cartoonist who created them. And so he quit, and the strip was continued briefly by somebody else, I believe, and then it was completely discontinued. Part of the whole enterprise must have been that the comic strip circulation was slipping. The name of the strip was Rick O'Shea, mm-hmm. and it began as a sort of a parody or lampoon of the conventions of the Old West as we find them in Hollywood. And over the years, it became more and more realistic. By the time it finished, Stan Lynde was telling quite realistic stories involving his characters, and he was drawing them about as realistically as you could expect. After he left Rick O'Shea, he did another strip, which was unabashedly realistic, called Latigo, which was about a kind of troubleshooting drifter in the Old West. When Rick O'Shea began, it wasn't set in the Old West. It was set in the Modern West. And one of the, if I'm remembering this right, sort of a rhetorical trick was that the characters in it tried to behave as if they were in the Old West. Well, by the time it ended, Stan Lynde had transported the whole milieu back 50 or 100 years, and they were in the Old West.
Yep,
Stan Lynde is still working, by the way. He's no longer doing any cartooning. He did a panel strip, which was distributed by himself, self-syndicated, called Grassroots. It was about a couple cowboys and making philosophical observations about life. But he's also written two novels, and a third one is currently looking for a publisher. The two novels, one of them was called The Bodacious Kid, and it was followed by a sequel about the same character called Careless Creek. They're very good. Stan is an accomplished writer, and his both of those novels are first-person narratives by the Bodacious Kid himself, whose name I've forgotten. And he speaks in a lingo that easily passes for authentic old American West language.
So there you go.
Thank you.
All right.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Other questions are certainly welcome. We've got about 10 minutes left. Our guest is Bob Harvey. He's a cartoon historian. And if you're interested in the history of the art, you can go out and look for some of his books. He's written several. And if you have questions, you can call us 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Next up is a caller from around Paris there on a car phone here, line number one.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have two to ask questions about. Back in the mid-50s, there was a cartoon character around Chicago, I think Mr. O'Malley, who was a leprechaun, and his sidekick was a an 8, 9, 10-year-old, and I have several of those collections, but whatever happened to that? The other one I will ask questions about is a usually a panel cartoon called Little Man on Campus. That was, I get a chuckle out of that, so apparently you know Little Man on Campus. I'm going to hang up because otherwise I'll get feedback on the car phone.
Okay, well, thanks for the call.
Mr. O'Malley appeared in a comic strip called Barnaby. And Mr. O'Malley was a pixie. Barnaby, who was a little kid about 6 years old, thought Mr. O'Malley was his fairy godfather, and that's how he appeared. He had pink wings, and he smoked a cigar, which he told everybody was his a magic wand. He actually could perform, according to the strip, he occasionally was able to perform acts of magic, although you could easily interpret them as coincidental occurrences over which he had absolutely no control, particularly when they occurred in the exact opposite manner than Mr. O'Malley intended. His favorite expression was Kushla McCree, Gee Willikers, that's the expression. It was drawn by Crockett Johnson. That's a pen name. The unusual feature of the strip was that all the lettering in the speech balloon was typeset. And that's because Crockett Johnson, by trade, was a typographer, among other things. The strip ran from about 1940 or 41 until 1948 or so, and Crockett Johnson gave it up, and it was done by a couple of other people for a while. And then it sort of deteriorated, and Crockett Johnson came back and did the last year or so of the strip, and I think it ran until about 1962, something like that. Gosh, I forgot what the other one was.
Little Man on Campus?
Oh, yeah. That was by a guy named Dick Bibler. And it was one of the early syndicated features drawn expressly for college campus newspapers. And I believe he syndicated it himself. It was a panel cartoon. The Little Man on Campus was a complete failure. He was a loser. And he never quite succeeded in anything. They've been collected in a couple little paperback booklets. I have a couple of them at home, and yeah, I don't know, you might be able to find them around. It disappeared, I don't know when. It was still running when I was in college, so it was probably going sometime through the late 50s and into the 60s.
Okay, good. At least one more here, back locally, Champaign, line two.
Oh, that's me.
Yes.
I listed Out Our Way, which was a square, and was all about different characters. Back in the 40s and 30s.
Right.
And about Milt Caniff, I want to ask about him, and I want to ask about Glias Williams.
Okay.
And Walt Kelly and the Teenyweenies. See how far back I go?
Yeah, right. Out Our Way was originated in the 20s by a cartoonist whose name was J.R. Williams.
That's right.
And he had done most of those things. He'd been a cowboy and worked in a machine shop and all that. One of the characters in the machine shop was Bull of the Woods.
Yeah.
The strip was continued. It may still be running, but it was operating until quite recently. J.R. Williams died in the late 50s or 60s. It was continued by somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
At one time, he had over 1,000 newspaper clients, which made him about the most highly circulated newspaper feature, comics feature at that time. That's in like the 50s or something.
Mm-hmm.
Milton Caniff originated a comic strip for the Associated Press called Dickie Dare.
Yes,
and after about
Terry
a year and a
Pirates.
Half... What?
It became Terry and the Pirates.
Well, after about a year and a half, he took the concept, which was a young boy having adventures in the company of his older male mentor,
mm-hmm.
and invented Terry and the Pirates and the Dragon Lady and a whole bunch of colorful characters, which lasted him through the war. And after the war, he started drawing Steve Canyon.
Ah.
And the reason he drew Steve Canyon was because Marshall Field, who founded the Chicago Sun, needed to have comic strips in the paper that would compete with the Chicago Tribune. The Tribune had Dick Tracy and Terry and the Pirates and Gasoline Alley and Little Orphan Annie and Smiling Jack and a whole lot of really top-drawer things. So he went Marshall Field approached each one of these cartoonists and asked them if they would, you know, leave the Tribune and work for him, and none of them said yes, except Kniff. And he said to Kniff, you know, what would it take for you to come and draw a comic strip for me? And Kniff said, I want complete editorial control and ownership of the feature. And he had neither of those with Terry and the Pirates. And Marshall Field said, done, and let's have a drink. And he beckoned to his butler, who brought in a tray of drinks, and they had a drink on it, and that was it.
That's quite wonderful.
Walt Kelly drew Pogo, of course, which one of the early strips to deal with political figures in a really overt fashion. Little Abner by Al Capp had been, you know, attacking the establishment right for years, and then he attacked the establishment left after that. He wasn't either conservative or liberal. He was against bullies. And when he started out in the 30s, the establishment was conservative, and they were the bullies. And by the time we had, you know, the student New Left in the 60s, why, he perceived that the New Left was the bullies, so he attacked them. But he never attacked politicians by name. Neither did Kelly.
No.
But he drew his characters to look like the objects of his ridicule.
I remember.
Yeah. Who else did you mention?
I'm going way back. The Teeny Weenies.
Oh, yeah. That was by a man named William Doheny. D-O-N-E-H-Y, I believe it was.
Wonderful artist.
His brother was an editorial cartoonist for one of the Cleveland papers. And Doheny drew the Teeny Weenies. These are people that were about 3 inches tall.
Yes.
And interestingly, you could say about that, here was a man who had drawn a feature about little people for 50 years, and he died the day before the last one was published.
Oh, for goodness sake.
It was exactly what happened to Charles Schulz and Peanuts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think you've covered most of them.
Okay.
Well, thanks for the call. We're at a point where we're going to have to stop. But I'm sure that Bob would come back on another day, and we could find some other things to talk about. In the meantime, if you're interested in the subject of comic art, just mention again two of his books. One is The Art of the Funnies. The other is The Art of the Comic Book, and they're both published by the University Press of Mississippi. And you also could check out his website, if you like, which is www.rcharvey.com. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
And
thank
happy
you.
Cartoonist Day.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you.